As someone who more than occasionally forgets things, I'm all too familiar with the expression that you'd lose your head if it weren't attached to your shoulders. Yes, it's an amusing mental image, but surely someone couldn't actually misplace a vital bodily organ. And if your job was to make sure that a donated kidney got to a recipient on time, I mean, you couldn't possibly just leave it, like, sitting at the Atlanta airport for hours on end, right?
The kidney is supposed to make a connecting flight in Atlanta.
And I just remember the phone ringing, and I answered it, and she said, the kidney did not get on the flight.
Are you kidding me? Look, I know everybody makes mistakes, and I also know that being able to take an organ out of one body and put it into another body is a miracle of modern science. But all too often, organs that could have been donated, organs that were intended to be donated, that could have saved someone's life, those organs never make it where they're supposed to go. And the ones that get lost in transit, like that kidney in the Atlanta airport, that's actually a small percentage of the problem. When that happens, sometimes it makes the news. But what you'll never hear about, what I'd never heard about until I started working on this podcast, are the thousands of organs that could have been donated every year, but simply don't get collected. That's a huge failure in terms of lives and money.
It's hurting patients, it's hurting the taxpayers, and we've got to get to some real accountability.
And thinking about that led me to another question. What if we allowed organ donors to get paid instead of relying on a system entirely based on charity?
So the current system, we romanticize altruism. And secondly, we shouldn't be blinded by that sentiment, which is magnificent, but blinded to the point where we allow people to die, because that's the only kind of system that we will permit, is one driven by altruism.
I'm Eric Boehm, and you're listening to my Reason Magazine podcast series about how the government's involvement in healthcare is making us sicker and poorer, and about how free markets and more freedom can cure that. In today's episode, I'm exploring how the federally funded and controlled organ donation system is failing patients who desperately need transplants, and what we could do to fix it. This is why we can't have nice things. So if you're like me, about the only time you think about organ donation is when you go to renew your driver's license and you see that little box that asks whether you want to be added to the National Registry. Most people check it. The battle of hearts and minds has been won, at least when it comes to the question of donating hearts and, well, kidneys, livers, and so on.
95% of Americans support organ donation. It literally polls higher than puppies and ice cream, we checked. So Americans are doing their part. They are generous. But it turns out that literally tens of thousands of organs that Americans want to donate are not making it to their intended recipients every year.
This is Jennifer Erickson.
And I'm a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists.
Jennifer points out that getting people to sign up to be organ donors is really the easy part. It's a little uncomfortable to think about the rest of the process because in most cases, we'll only encounter it when a loved one has died. But understanding how the donation process plays out is actually essential to understanding what's broken. Okay, so I'm dead, and the government, and I'm an organ donor that's on my driver's license. The hospital is going to call up who exactly, and what is the next step in that process?
Well, only about 2 or 3% of deaths are from people who are dying in an organ donation eligible way. Because if you think about it, right, something's happened to you, but one or up to eight of your organs are okay. So think about car accidents, overdoses, traumas, strokes, things like that. So what happens is every hospital is assigned to one organ procurement organization, or OPO. That is a government monopoly. So if already you're thinking there's a problem, you're right. It is a government monopoly that is supposed to then turn up at the hospital at every organ donation eligible case every time and have a conversation with the family in the next of kin, or they'll have one of two versions of the conversation. Smith family, I'm so sorry for your loss. John was a registered organ donor. We'd like to go ahead and honor his wishes. Or, Smith family, I'm so sorry for your loss. John seemed like a wonderful person. Can we talk to you about organ donation? Now, keep in mind that 95% stat, right? I don't know if my brother is a registered organ donor or not. But if the OPO shows up, God forbid, if he passed away in an organ donation eligible way, I believe him to be one of the 95%. So I would say yes. Whether he registered or not, though, if that government contractor doesn't show up, his organs, your organs, my organs cannot be recovered. And that's where the problem is.
According to researchers at the University of Pennsylvania and a nonprofit called Organize, get it? Organize. They say that 28,000 donatable organs are going uncollected each year, including 17,000 kidneys. Now, one in five kidneys is thrown away after being harvested rather than making it to a recipient, and the rest are just never getting collected in the first place. Meanwhile, there are more than 100,000 people on the waiting list to receive an organ transplant. The vast majority of them are waiting for a new kidney, and many will die before they get one. At the root of all this are those OPOs that Jennifer mentioned a moment ago. That's an organ procurement organization. There are 56 of them that operate around the country, and each has its own exclusive territory. Then there's the United Network for Organ Sharing, or UNOS, which is the national entity that handles the donation lists, coordinates between the local OPOs, and handles logistics.
An organ transplant replaces a failing organ with a healthy one from another person. That's where UNOS comes in. United Network for Organ Sharing matches...
This is the system that Congress set up back in the early 1980s. That's when organ donation became more widespread, thanks to some advances in surgery and immune-suppressing drugs.
So a little bit of history, if you'll hang with me. In the mid-80s, that's when immunosuppression was developed. So why does that matter? Well, then it didn't have to just be twin sibling donating to their twin. It could be strangers donating to each other. And so Congress, in an effort to tap into that generosity and support it, decided to set up this national network. So it came from a really good place.
In fact, the law that created the Organ Donation Network had broad bipartisan support, and it was pushed through Congress by a pair of senators that you've probably heard of before, Republican Orrin Hatch of Utah and Democrat Al Gore of Tennessee. It was signed by President Ronald Reagan.
Who, like Ashley, are waiting for transplants if donors can only be found. I gave a phone number where possible donors could respond. Well, God bless you all. The response was overwhelming. Over 5,000 calls were received from people in 47 states. Many callers asked for donor cards so they could help.
But good intentions don't always equal good results.
But what they did wasn't fit for purpose, because what they did is they granted a monopoly to everyone who's always already on the ground. They said these organ procurement organizations had popped up around transplant centers around the country. Sort of looks like a Jackson Pollock painting. Some are big, some are little. But in any case, they froze time. And they said, if you're already there, go get those organs. You have a monopoly. So one, monopolies aren't great. But the other point is they made them funded on a cost reimbursement basis. And this is one of the last remaining healthcare programs where this is still true. So what does that mean? It means whatever these contractors spend, they get to pass those costs onto the payer, which is usually people listening, the taxpayer.
So there's one national organization that's a monopoly government contractor overseeing a bunch of local monopolies. There's no competition, and whatever they spend is fully reimbursed, either by the government or by private health insurers.
You're a monopoly. You're not competing with anyone. You can't, they've never lost their contract, so there's no, has been no federal oversight. There's no financial restrictions. They get paid the same regardless of how many organs they recover. So what we've ended up with is there is literally a 400% difference between the highest performing contractors and the lowest performing contractors. So some of these are doing their job. That's great. They should keep doing it. But how wild is it in a life and death issue that's costing 33 American lives every single day that the taxpayer funds that we'd be funding this kind of deadly failure?
When Jennifer first told me about how bad the track record for organ donations are, I kind of had a hard time believing her. Getting an organ from one patient to another is advanced medical science, sure, but really, it's kind of just logistics. There's a donor list, deaths happen pretty regularly, and the vast majority of Americans have agreed to be organ donors. So it doesn't seem like it should be that complicated. But then I discovered that this has been a problem, and for a long time. A series of articles in Forbes in the late 1990s detailed the problems with UNOS. The magazine called it a federal monopoly that's chilling the supply of transplantable organs and letting Americans who need them die needlessly. More than 20 years later, not much seems to have changed. In 2021, a Department of Health and Human Services report concluded that the single-source contract for UNOS meant that the government had little leverage to force the organization to improve. The report concluded by stating that there are little to no incentives for UNOS to ever modernize its operations due to the monopoly contract that it holds.
Today, we want to discuss about the U.S. Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network. Thousands of organs go to waste each year, resulting in lives lost and billions of dollars wasted.
That's Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa during a Senate Finance Committee hearing in 2022. Grassley has been pushing for organ donation reform for years, although until recently he hasn't had much success.
One official's response to these concerns was to suggest rural Americans were dumb and should be just moved somewhere else to obtain life-saving treatment. And of course, that attitude is totally unacceptable.
When Organized tracked donation conversion rates for the regional OPOs in 2019, it found that only six of them collected at least 50% of the available donatable organs within their territory. That's six out of more than 50. Now, there are two problems here. First, as Jennifer alluded to earlier, some of the OPOs are just doing a very poor job of collecting donatable organs. And fewer organs collected means fewer organs available for transplants. And because there's no competition between the OPOs, if you're unlucky enough to need an organ and you live in an area where there's a poor performing OPO, you might never get one.
And we know from national data and research that as a whole, organ procurement organizations are only half as likely to even turn up and talk to a black family as a white family and honor those wishes, which is just mind-blowing, right? It's hugely disrespectful to those families. It artificially constrains supply. And same ethnicity matches are more likely. So if you are not talking to a black family in Philadelphia, you are absolutely hurting the next black patient on the waiting list, whether they're in Philadelphia, DC, or Texas. So that's the first problem.
The second problem is all about logistics. The local contractors and UNOS, the national monopoly contractor, they're supposed to share responsibility for getting organs from point A to point B. But they do a bad job. According to a report from Kaiser Health News, 6% of organ shipments over a six-year period experience transportation delays of more than 2 hours. By comparison, major airlines lose or damage about one-half of 1% of luggage. And 2% of organs were unable to be transplanted because of those delays. UNOS points out that it's post-9/11 airport security that's partially to blame for this. Before those measures were put into place, organs could be transported in the main cabin of airplanes under the direct supervision of the flight crew, and they would be ready to be handed off quickly after landing. But nowadays, federal regulations require donated organs to travel in the luggage compartment, and that's an arrangement that wastes precious time and adds additional logistical hurdles.
So think about how sophisticated logistics are in the United States. Your listeners probably have things delivered to their house just about every week, if not every day. And then think about something as valuable, and I mean that in every sense of the word, as a human organ being left on the counter, being tracked with paper and pencil manifests and not electronically tracked. I mean, it's outrageous that toothpaste or your Chick-fil-A order would be tracked with more integrity than a human kidney, but that's the system that we've been left with an unaccountable monopoly.
And if an airline loses my bag, I can say, well, I'm never flying with that airline again. But there's only one organization that's legally allowed to operate the organ transplant network. No matter how many times UNOS screws up, donors and doctors and recipients have no other choice.
And so I think the key message here is monopolies don't work, and government-funded monopolies are even worse.
Waiting for a new organ can be mentally and physically debilitating. Dialysis extends lives, but having to get your blood filtered through a fake kidney 3 times a week kind of sucks. And it's just a temporary fix. An estimated 12 people die every day waiting for a new kidney.
Wasted bodies, lying low, so stiff, so many lovers in need of organs. Wasted bodies, lying low, so stiff, so many lovers
in need of... No, on the other hand, thank God it exists, because if you need, like, a liver, there's no what's called bridging technology to hold you until you get a liver. Now, dialysis, your life will surely end prematurely if you stay on dialysis as opposed to get a kidney, but at least it won't end in a month, which it well might within a month to 2 weeks if your kidneys just shut down.
Meet Sally Sittell.
I'm actually a psychiatrist, and I work part-time in a methadone clinic, but I spend most of my time as a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
She was diagnosed with kidney failure in 2004. And she ended up on the transplant list.
I actually just went for a regular checkup and felt fine, but the blood tests were very worrisome, and this is just a basic blood test. And so the doctor called me up and said, get in here, and said, pretty soon, although no one can ever really predict when, but you'll probably, you will need a kidney or you'll have to go on dialysis, which is sadly the fate of most people who do need a kidney.
There's a fun personal story here for Reason superfans, and that is that you have inside you right now a kidney that once resided inside former Reason editor-in-chief Virginia Pastorell. Tell us, if you don't mind, how that came to happen.
Yes, in fact, my first kidney donor was Virginia Pastorell. And if I sound really smart today, it's because I've taken on some of her IQ points. Of course, I don't believe in that, but there is a mythology, especially with heart transplants, that you take on some characteristics of the person who gave you the kidney, gave you the organ. So yeah, Virginia, we weren't that close. We knew each other. And in fact, I was over a year into my kidney search, which was not going well. And in fact, I even went online on a site called matchingdonors.com, which is kind of like a J-date for people who need organs, mostly kidneys, though. And I did have a match, and we were set up to go through the surgery in, I think it was January 2006, and the guy just disappeared. Yeah, so fortunately, I had a friend who saw Virginia in November, I think it was of 2005, and the friend just said, or Virginia just said, how's Sally doing? And the friend said, she needs a kidney. And then I got an email from Virginia, and the subject matter said, serious offer. And she said, I heard, that you need a kidney, and if I'm a match, I will do it. And of course, you just become, speechless with, gratitude over that kind of sentiment. But I also realized after a while how lucky I was.
Yeah, I guess the point to get at here is that you got lucky in a way that lots of people don't.
That's right, and they pay for that bad luck with their life. Mm-hmm. And that's why we need more organ donors. We've tried everything. We've tried education. People sign their organ donor card, which is wonderful, but not enough people die in such a way that allows their organs to be used. We've allow people to be reimbursed, not that generously, to be honest, but because the government puts a cap on it if you have to seek the help from the government, but to be reimbursed for the donor expenses. Sometimes you have to go to a different city or stay in a hotel or childcare or this kind of thing. And it can really add up, and that helps. Still, it's still not enough. It's at the margins, these kind of improvements. And as far as I'm concerned, and I'm certainly not alone in this, belief, is to be able to compensate people who are willing to give a kidney.
Okay, so how would that work?
Oh, look here now. You bet hard, fed, and good here. What about it there? Damn bit. How many dollars here, sir? $140, $1 down, $3.
No, nothing like that. Seitel's idea wouldn't involve auctioning off organs or handing over suitcases of cash to prospective donors.
So you're not going to be doing back alley transplants or giving bad kidneys because physicians just wouldn't transplant them. First, keep in mind that dialysis costs a fortune. It is 7% of the Medicare budget, and it covers fewer than 1% of Medicare beneficiaries. It's a massive expenditure. I want to say $60 billion a year, but it's a lot. And so that's where the pool of money would come from to reward / compensate donors with a lot left over. And so the idea would be that a person who is interested in giving a donor to a stranger, this was the original plan, to just make people who were stranger donors eligible for this. But I think there's a good argument that could be made that anyone who gives a kidney to a relative should be eligible for a $50,000 to $100,000, whatever the amount decided upon, tax credit, that they would receive this after the kidney transplant. There would just be part of the, it would be part of the IRS, you know, forms. And of course you'd have to verify it with documentation from the hospital. And this would be distributed over 5 years, again, or 10. And if you don't pay taxes, it would be refundable. And that really is elegant.
Just to point out the obvious objection that gets raised whenever this idea is discussed, wouldn't legalizing the sale of your own organs incentivize desperate people, maybe people with gambling debts, let's say, to sell their organs, to pay off a bookie, feed a drug addiction, or loan money to an abusive partner? As Sally explained, probably the best way to avoid the worst perverse incentives here is to make sure that no one is getting paid with a literal or even metaphorical suitcase full of cash. The payments would be distributed over a long period of time, possibly as tax credits, rather than as a lump sum. But there are other precautions that could be built into the system, too.
Of course, there's informed consent. That's true for everyone. But you could make that more robust if you wanted to by requiring that people become kind of certified kidney donors, the way you become a certified scuba diver. You have to take a test. But anyway, it's clear that the person knows what they're doing. And as I said, they wouldn't get cash. And then, you know, they would go through the process like anyone else.
How worried should we be about creating some of these perverse incentives? You said, you know, maybe somebody will feel like, you know, their money or their, you know, your money or your life kind of situation. It's never that. But if somebody can sell a kidney for $100,000 and they need $100,000 to keep their house out of foreclosure or whatever, should we be concerned as libertarians or just as human beings about somebody making that calculus of saying, well, I would rather give a kidney to save my house? Like, or is that entirely up to that person to make that decision on their own?
Well, again, as I mentioned, this money would not be available up front and in that amount. So that protects against that. I certainly am, though, frankly, sympathetic to arguments that as long as a person knows what they're doing, and again, that's why I really think the most important part of this is not the cash so much, cash or non-cash. It's whether people are informed and there's been a cooling off period that... you know, it's their money, and you hope they put it to a good cause, as opposed to, well, I don't mind if they buy a Porsche either, but I mean, you know, something that really enhances their life in a fundamental way.
But it wouldn't be a suitcase of cash anyway, so
no,
it's not
never.
Like,
so,
right, it's
yes,
not like that would be an option,
so
right?
That, right. I mean, every, as I say, almost every argument I've heard, and some are reasonable, like, here's another one. What if, well... You know, what if really poor people want to do it? I don't think so. I actually think graduate students are going to want to do it. People who are pretty well educated but with earning potential, but right now they need, you know, they need more security. But who knows? That's an empirical matter, and we should see. If you think that low-income people shouldn't have the right to decide what's in their best interest, being in, you know, given that they're well-informed, okay. So build in an income floor. Or ceiling floor, where you have to make twice or three times the poverty rate in order to participate.
Now, you might be thinking, hold on. This is fundamentally different from the not enough kidneys problem that Jennifer was talking about a few minutes ago. And you'd be right. Jennifer is calling attention to the problems with the current system of transplants, where a lot of kidneys and other organs are going to waste instead of making their way to people who need them. Sally is aiming to increase the number of people who are willing to donate a kidney in the first place. Both of their efforts are linked by the biggest obstacle to them. That's the 1984 National Organ Transplant Act.
The House has passed a bill that would set up programs to help find donors for those in need of organ transplants. The measure also outlaws trafficking in organs.
Congressman Albert Gore of Tennessee, the bill's author, says thousands of lives could be saved each year if there were more organ donors and a better system of matching up people who need transplant surgery with available organs.
We've reached the point with organ transplantation where we can no longer just respond on an ad hoc basis and get the transplant treatment to the person who can get publicity and get the attention of members of Congress or the president.
The measure passed by the House authorized...
It was that law that made UNOS the national monopoly contractor that oversees the organ transplant system. The same law also prohibits the purchase or sale of human organs, and it's that language that is a major impediment to the reforms Sally is proposing.
It was Al Gore. In 1983, because he actually spearheaded the National Organ Transplant Act, and he said in a hearing that effectively, well, we'll try altruism first, and if it's not adequate, we should think of moving to a contribution. I think he used the example of a contribution to a person's estate.
So now, 40 years after that law was originally passed, is it time to revisit that fundamental idea? Should you be compensated in some way for donating an organ? It's a question that demands we ask a more philosophical one. What's the value of a kidney? Right now, federal law mandates that they are effectively valued at $0. But while it's against the law for an individual to be compensated for donating a kidney, the same isn't true for those 50-ish regional monopolies that operate under UNOS's umbrella. In that same 1984 law that created the Organ Exchange Network, Congress said it would fully reimburse all costs associated with kidney donation. Effectively, the laws said that the OPOs can get paid for managing a transplant and that they get to set the price. So I asked Jennifer why that's unusual and potentially problematic.
It means whatever these contractors spend, they get to pass those costs onto the payer, which is usually people listening, the taxpayer, right? So private jets, pass it on. Artwork, pass it on. Multi-million-dollar salaries, taking your board on a Sonoma wine retreat, that all goes into the cost of the organ. That is all passed on to the payer. And again, surprise, surprise, the payer is usually the taxpayer, you and me, through Medicare.
The idea to make organ donation fully cost reimbursed might have been well-intentioned. But the downside is that these regional monopolies now have very little incentive to control their costs. And that's caused a bunch of shenanigans. One legacy, the organ procurement organization with a monopoly in Southern California, got dinged by an inspector general report after it spent $327,000 on Rose Bowl tickets and other events connected to the big college football game in 2006. Some of those costs ended up being billed to taxpayers via Medicare. In a 2021 Senate hearing, the president and CEO of the Nevada Donor Network, another one of the regional OPOs, admitted that the group has season tickets for the National Football League's Las Vegas Raiders and the National Hockey League's Las Vegas Golden Knights. And they've spent money on multiple board retreats to California wine country. And this cost reimbursement policy has also contributed to at least one pretty shocking federal crime.
He threatened to kill my parents and to kill me, to cremate me alive.
That's Barry Tall talking to CBS News in 2019. 7 years earlier, Tall had been working at a funeral home in Alabama when he accidentally overheard his bosses and an executive from the Alabama Organ Center discussing a scheme to rip off taxpayers.
He says he overheard his boss talking to the directors of the Organ Center.
Jed said, look, if you want more money, you're going to have to start padding these bills better. My boy, he said, you got to grease some palms in this world if you want to make some money. Something's wrong. Padding bills. I mean, I'm not a genius. Doesn't take a Phi Beta Kappa to figure that out, right?
What Barry had unknowingly stumbled upon was a kickback scheme worth millions.
Tall brought a whistleblower lawsuit against the owners of that funeral home where he worked. His attorneys estimated that the kickback scheme involving the Alabama Organ Center resulted in up to $60,000 per month in false charges being billed to taxpayers. In the end, a judge awarded Tall more than $14.7 million. Meanwhile, one of the executives from the Alabama Organ Center ended up in federal prison after pleading guilty to charges of healthcare fraud and mail fraud. But the organ donation center in question is still operating today. It just has a different name. Now it's known as the Legacy of Hope. After the scandal and the rebranding, it's still the only OPO operating in Alabama.
We were established in 1979 as the Alabama Organ Bank. Changed our name a number of years later to the Alabama Organ Center to better represent what we do. We're actually in the middle of a rebranding program as we speak. So this fall we may be called something else. I'm not allowed to tell you because it's a surprise. We will do a lot to announce should we change our name and have a new look. Same great place, but new look.
The problems extend to the national monopoly, too. In 2022, the Washington Post reported that UNOS's computer systems, which are used to match organ donors to recipients, were outdated and would frequently crash for hours at a time. That's potentially a big problem when you're dealing with a time-sensitive situation like where to send newly recovered organs. We asked UNOS about those problems with the computer system and asked the network to comment on the other figures that we've shared in this episode, including the claim that 17,000 kidneys are slipping through the cracks of the donation system every year. In response, a spokeswoman for UNOS said that the organization has consistently met or exceeded contract requirements across the board, including for system uptime, exceeding 99.9% availability since 2006. Delays in organ matching as a result of downtime are managed at the donor level, and as a result, organ offers have not been missed. The system's longest period of downtime was 200 minutes during May of 2012. In response to our other questions about organs not being collected at high enough rates and many going to waste, UNOS pointed to the recent creation of a special task force that's been given the goal of bringing transplant centers and OPOs together to improve organ usage and placement efficiency. Additionally, the spokeswoman for UNOS pointed to several ongoing efforts that the organization is undertaking to improve the transplant network. That includes better data collection, improved transparency, and reductions in the number of organs that get lost in transit. As part of that last effort, UNOS has established a working group with the Federal Aviation Administration with the goal of once again allowing organs to be transported in the main cabin of commercial airplanes. For a full list of those efforts, you can head over to UNOS's Action Agenda on the organization's website. Find that at unos.org. There are lives at stake here, obviously, but there's also a lot of money to be saved if we could create a more functional organ donation system. By one estimate, every Medicare patient who gets a new kidney this year will save taxpayers $250,000 in future dialysis costs. And tax-funded healthcare programs are spending more than $100 billion every year just to treat kidney disease. And that includes the cost of dialysis.
So when we think about making sure we are recovering kidneys, we are not losing kidneys. Not only are we starting with honoring the wishes of those generous American organ donors and their family, we have every incentive to get it right. Because every kidney transplant that happens, not only does that patient live much longer than they would on dialysis, much higher quality of life, we save $1.5 million per patient. So that is a hell of a Yahtzee in policy and healthcare, right?
For Jennifer, this effort also carries some personal stakes.
Father was a Navy pilot. He served for 25 years, was grateful to serve. He is now buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Never said anything about the disease, the cancer which took multiple of his organs. It was a really tough last 7 years. We were very fortunate. My brother, Jeff, was a match for my dad and was willing to donate. Because my father lost his kidney to cancer, they wanted to wait 3 years before the transplant because then he'd go on to immunosuppression. And so we were literally at the hospital for both of them to get their surgeries when they declared my father too sick to transplant. Because he was a ornery Navy pilot, he lived in a lot of pain on dialysis for 4 more years. But I bring that up because not everyone has a living donor like my dad would have had and my brother. And it was a real moment of revelation for me, because in those 3 years, he went from being an otherwise healthy, strong, if cantankerous, retired Navy pilot to someone who couldn't walk across the room and is too sick to transplant. And we make patients wait 3 years, 5 years, 10 years for organs. A lot of them die during that wait on the waiting list. And a lot of them, like my dad, get declared too sick to transplant. And so it just made me think we have to fix this. We have to make the system better so we don't make people get that sick while they wait.
There's also something to be said here about the limits of a system that's built entirely on altruism.
So the current system, we romanticize altruism. And of course, you know, I'm sitting here as the embodiment of it. But I realize that, first off, it's not always the case. And secondly, we shouldn't be blinded by that sentiment, which is magnificent, but blinded to the point where we allow people to die because that's the only kind of system that we will permit is one driven by altruism.
Giving a kidney to a friend is an act of self-sacrifice, but we should ask whether the government contractors running the system share that commitment to selflessness. Some, it would seem, do not. But we get to wrap up here with a bit of good news. After years of hearings and reports and discussions, both Congress and the executive branch have recently made some changes. First, regulations implemented by the Trump administration and continued by the Biden administration have created a new layer of accountability for the 50-odd local organ procurement organizations. For the first time, poor-performing organizations could actually lose their contracts.
Every single part of the country should be served by a high-performing organ procurement organization. Again, that shouldn't be a lofty, faraway goal. The federal government has to replace failing organ procurement organizations with the high performers that are serving American people, and they have to do it now. We should never be in a situation where there's this kind of unaccountable monopoly again. There needs to be open, fair, competitive contracting, and if someone new comes in and they fail the American people, they should be kicked out too.
In 2023, Congress made one small but potentially significant change to the 1984 Organ Transplant Act. Now, for the first time, there could be open bidding for the federal contract that UNOS has held since 1984.
If the government is paying for it, and that is absolutely what they're doing, then we have to keep an eye on what we're paying for. That should be government 101, taxpayer responsibility 101. And if it's life or death, good night, moon, we have to be watching what's happening, right? And so the thing about having it, why I think it's gotten so much bipartisan support, is it's a fever dream of everything that's wrong for both sides, right? Because it's government funded in the private sector with no accountability and no competition. I mean, if you were trying to come up with a cocktail, with greatest respect to what was done in the 80s, of what could go wrong, that's how you'd write it, right?
Despite all of these problems, the lack of competition, the lack of oversight, the wasteful spending, the lost organs, the missed opportunities. Despite all of that, Americans keep doing their part. There are more organ donors now than ever before. And as Jennifer put it, organ donation polls higher than ice cream and puppies. It's the government and its contractors that are the reason some people die while waiting for an organ they might have otherwise received.
So when I say this death is unnecessary, I don't mean in some high-minded future state. I mean Americans are doing their job. The federal government needs to catch up to that. If we actually break those numbers down further, the lowest estimate of unrecovered, untransplanted organs every year is 17,500 kidneys, 7,500 livers, 1,500 hearts, 1,500 lungs. That is enough to completely eliminate the waiting list for livers, hearts, and lungs in 3 years, and the kidney waiting list would come way down. So when you think about this as a solvable problem, what we have to do is follow the data. There aren't that many issues in healthcare where we can see exactly what's working and exactly what's not, where we can pull the parties together and say, hang on a second, why are we paying for failure?
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You've been listening to the latest episode of my podcast, Why We Can't Have Nice Things. Big thanks to my guests today, Jennifer Erickson from the Federation of American Scientists and Sally Sittel from the American Enterprise Institute. For more on Erickson's work, head over to FAS.org and check out her recent interview with Santi Ruiz on his Substack. That's actually how I first came across this issue, so additional thanks to Santi for that. You can find that at statecraft.pub. Sally Sittel's work is available at AEI.org, and look for her book, When Altruism Isn't Enough, The Case for Compensating Organ Donors. We have two episodes to go in this second season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and I can't wait to share next week's with you. I'm speaking with a cancer specialist in Boston who says that restrictions on telemedicine in some states are putting her in a bind. Does she follow the law or listen to her ethical obligations as a doctor? That's coming up next Thursday. Today's episode was written by Eric Boehm and produced by Hunt Beatty, fact-checking by Anthony Wallace. Our executive editor at Reason is Jim Epstein. Check out the rest of Why We Can't Have Nice Things and all of our other podcasts at Reason.com and wherever you get your pods. We've now hit double digits. This was the 10th episode in the history of this podcast, so catch up on all the rest if you haven't heard them yet, and we'll see you back here next week.
lying low, so stupid, so many lies.